Mastermind Agent is proud to present the Interview of the Month Club. Top agents, rising agents, team members, and guests from across North America reveal their success secrets, strategies, and systems in up-close and personal interviews. You can find all the club interviews at www.mastermindagent.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Cerrone with Mastermind Agent. This month's top agent is Russell Shaw with Realty One Group in Phoenix, Arizona. Last year, he closed 403 transactions with a total sales volume of $55 million. His average sales price was $136,000, of which 30% were buyers and 70% were sellers. He operates a team with 18 members, 2 listing specialists, 5 buyer specialists, 1 general manager, 1 operations manager, 1 contract negotiator, 2 transaction managers, 2 short sale negotiators, 1 short sale processor, 1 client care coordinator, and 3 administrative. Russell Shaw is the team leader of the Russell Shaw Group. He has been an agent for 34 years and works the Metro Phoenix market. Russell is a billion-dollar agent. He has sold over $1 billion worth of homes in his career. In his best year, 2006, Russell sold 405 homes worth $104 million. But it's not always been this good. Russell was an average, ordinary agent for his first 12 years in the business, closing about 20 transactions per year. He was tired of living paycheck to paycheck. Russell decided he would either make it big or get out and do something else. He learned and implemented the number one most successful strategy for rising to the top in real estate, and he will share it with you in detail. Russell is the godfather of radio ads. Dozens of agents have learned from the master and duplicated his successful ads in markets around the country. Radio and TV advertising is the source of 80% of his business, and he invests over $600,000 each year. Russell goes into great detail about what works, what doesn't, and how you can make radio and TV work for you. He describes scripts, hot buttons, keywords, production, station selection, cost, best days of the week, frequency, mistakes, and more. Russell also talks in-depth about listings, listing specialists, DISC personality test, short sale seller seminars, personal newspapers, and more. Russell will disclose the number one most important skill any agent needs to have to survive and thrive in any market. Welcome to the call, Russell.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Mike.
Russell, before we talk about what you're doing today, let's go back for a minute and talk about what you were doing before you got into real estate.
Oh, actually, I was in the life insurance business. It was something I'm not saying it's a bad business, but I hated it. I always struggled to make myself work. I couldn't believe how much I didn't like it. I would keep giving myself these pep talks that I wanted to do it, but the truth is I didn't want to do it. When I got into real estate, it was almost unbelievable to me that I was so accustomed when I told someone I was in the insurance business, they would sort of walk the other way, so like they didn't want to talk about life insurance. So what was interesting is when you mentioned you could walk through a grocery store and tell someone you were in the real estate business, and everyone wants to talk about it. So finding people that wanted to talk to you about your business, to say it wasn't hard to do would be an understatement. I don't know how you could avoid doing it unless you just literally never told anyone you were a real estate agent. So I just found that to be a marked difference. And I did actually fairly well my first year. Nothing like I do now, but in terms of what is probably considered successful in the industry, I would have, you know, I was doing like, oh, my first 12 years in the business, I was doing between, you know, 17, 22 deals a year. That's oddly enough considered successful. I mean, companies now that average, where the agents average doing 10 or 11 deals a year, they brag about it. Like, like this actually was a big plus. I'm serious. This is actually something that people they're going like, well, our agents are more successful because our agents average 11 deals a year. And I think we take the average sales price in our area and go, now take that times 11 or 12 or something like that, and go try to live on it. It's not enough money. And I have many staff members that work for me make more money than that. I mean, it's not very much money. So really and truly, my first years in the business, I struggled because I was always living from paycheck to paycheck, from closing to closing. And I knew there was something better available, but I didn't know how to do it. And what that something is, this is a well-kept secret apparently, is be a lister. And it took me quite a while to learn how to be a lister. What I know now is that most agents never learn to list, and what stops them from learning to list is they think they already know. And that is the biggest barrier to learning anything, is having the false idea you already know. What most agents who think they know how to list, I'm not being condescending here, but what most agents who think they know how to take listings, these are people who do about 12 deals a year, and maybe 4 or 5 of those deals are listings. And all of their listings come from people who already know them, like them, and trust them. Well, they actually haven't learned to take listings. What they've learned to do is make friends with buyers, and then that person already will go, hey, why don't you come list my house? Since we just bought one or something like that. But if you're going to take listings in quantity, you are going to have to retrain yourself. And it's a completely different type of work. Working buyers is almost exclusively relationship-based selling. Being able to like have an affable personality and likable and be trustworthy and so forth, and you're qualified. That alone will not get you listings. It'll only get you listings from people who already know you, like you, and trust you. But that's, again, when you go after them and start really going after them, first thing you notice is if you're going to do it, it is presentation-based selling. It is not relationship-based selling. And it's lonely work. That's actually an interesting point, where if you're working buyers, it's got this, I don't know, you're driving around in the car, it's almost sort of like a party. If you have people you like, you know what I mean? Like if you're working a buyer that you really genuinely go, I like them, there's an almost party atmosphere, like they're schmoozing and this is a lot of fun and spending the time together and so forth. Going after listings is nothing like that, and anyone who has that idea, they're just not going to take very many listings because it just doesn't work that way. The difference is, and I know there's tons of people who will disagree with what I'm about to say, and I'll just go on record as saying they're wrong, but if you say, who pays the commission? There's no question in my mind who pays the commission. The seller pays the commission. And there are people who will say, well, yes, but they're paying it with money they got from the buyer. Well, if the seller sells it on a for sale by owner basis, he didn't pay a commission, so he didn't pay it with the buyer's money. He paid it with his own money, and he's always paying it with his own money. And the reason I'm saying that is to make a point that regardless of all of the people who I believe are mostly misguided, who want to separate commissions from the MLS and this sort of thing, the truth of the matter is that when you're working a buyer, you're not really asking them to give you any money. You're actually providing a valuable service, and you're doing it essentially from their point of view for free. And there's the difference, because when you go in to sell a house, let's just pretend that you were going to charge a 6% commission on a $200,000 house, or let's make it a $300,000 house. That would be $18,000. And you're going in going, I'm going to give you a nice sign, and here's what my brochure looks like, and I want you to list with me, and I'd like you to write me a check for $18,000. Well, if that's your listing presentation, you might not get as be understand, though. But that's actually the difference, and that is what the difference is between someone who's learning to list, because it's like, what are you going to say to show them that you're actually worth that amount of money. And there is the listing presentation. It's not a bunch of little flip charts and so forth. It's as though every seller in the country went to some class or a school of some kind where the instructor passed out a mimeograph sheet of questions, about 18, 20 questions, and they said on this list, these are the questions to ask a realtor when they come to your house to list your home. Don't ever let them see the list. Don't ever let the agent see this list. Keep it a secret, but you'll promise us you'll keep this a secret. We'll let you leave with a copy of it so you can be sure and stump the agents. And you get stuff, we didn't want to pay 6%, or we have a friend in the business, or there's somebody with Remax will do it for less. And those are the kinds of things. I'm not going to run off the whole list because it doesn't matter. The way you compile the list, the only valid way, in my opinion, to compile the list is go on enough listing appointments that you find out all the questions that they have. And when you get stumped, you won't get stumped by that one again because you'll work out an answer to that one before you go on your next appointment. And I believe that an agent needs to go on at least 50, that's 5-0 appointments, just to get their sea legs. It's not a matter of did you take listings on them, because if I were coaching someone, I don't care if they take a listing. It's did they go on an appointment? Did they get face-to-face at the kitchen table or at the dining room table with the seller? And if the answer is no, it was not an appointment. And, you know, when I hear new agents or even veteran, well, we list 95% of the appointments we go on. I think that kind of statement tells me the person doesn't keep very good stats, or they're so ego-motivated on making the statement. And if I'm rubbing someone the wrong way, I want to say good, because they're not going on enough appointments. That's just that simple. They're just not going on enough appointments. If the only people you call on are people you already know, you're not going on enough appointments.
Have you developed a list of these common objections on a listing appointment?
Oh, sure. I learned this from a man who wrote books. They're out of print now. When I got in the business in 1978, they were the best-selling books in real estate. His name was Gail Hemmah, G-A-E-L-H-I-M-M-A-H. The books were Listing Magic, Listing Master. And he listed FSBOs, and he would take a listing a day, and he wouldn't eat dinner until he got his listing. And he was a very disciplined guy. He retired to Hawaii. It's not a matter of here's the list. If I compiled the list, I wouldn't give it to anyone. It'd be a disservice. I know that sounds funny. It would be a colossal disservice because what has to happen is you have to go on appointments. There's nothing else will ever matter. If the person doesn't go on appointments, if they don't work it out, I mean, you can start working out what would be some objections, but if they don't go on appointments and get face-to-face with people, and if someone's interested in seeing what a listing appointment consists of on I have a blog called Number One, that's N-U-M-B-E-R, numeral one, home agent, numberonehomeagent.com. And there I have written up extensively everything about a listing appointment, what kind of materials to use, what kind of binding material to use, the material lays flat at the table, where to sit, where they're supposed to sit, everything. I've written it all up. And anyone, it's strictly for agents to use. I mean, it's not something you can put the link in there, even to the specific posts that they wrote back probably in, I don't remember, maybe 2007, 2008, I won't remember. But I've got this material for someone, what would a listing appointment consist of? But they have to go on the appointments to get it. It's not something they're going to. Like someone who doesn't go on listing appointments just won't know how to list. I don't know how else I'd say it.
You currently have a listing specialist, someone who goes out on these appointments that you've trained to do this.
Yes.
How did you train them? Did you just train them in the school of the hard knocks by throwing them out into the appointment multiple times, or did you try to give them some type of personal training before that?
All those things. The first thing I would say to anyone, and this is something I've learned the hard way, and I've seen people ignore it, I'm about to tell you, and they learned the hard way, don't violate this rule. So for anyone, I would say the most important book ever written on the subject of How to Grow Your Real Estate Business would undoubtedly be The Millionaire Real Estate Agent by Gary Keller. I start with that statement. When you start turning over various hats, the very, very, very last hat you turn over is taking listings. Like, you get rid of every other thing you do before you get rid of that one. Any attempt to sort of jump the shark on that one and get rid of it earlier and delegate it will just meet with complete failure. Like, you get rid of admin first, you hire an administrative assistant, get rid of your paperwork, then get rid of working buyers, get a buyer assistant, but don't reverse that order, get a buyer assistant. And after you get somebody to do contracts for you, get all that other stuff, the last thing you do is get rid of listings. And what I did when I first hired my first listing specialist, this would have been, I think, 15 years ago, but it might have been 14. I don't remember exactly. I had him come with me for a week just to watch me. And then for the following week, I went with him to watch him. By the time I hired my second lister, one time I had three. By the time I hired my second lister, I could not go in the house and have them watch me because of my TV ads. I'd become too much of a celebrity, and all they'd be seeing is the public real. Oh, hi, you're here. Oh, you're the guy on TV. And honestly, they wouldn't be able to learn anything. So I replicated that procedure as much as I could by having my top listing guy have the new lister go with him and watch him, and then he went with them, that kind of thing. But I couldn't go into the house anymore. They weren't going to learn anything by watching me because they weren't going to get to see me do it.
So you had your listing agent shadow you, and then you watched him for a week, and then he became the instructor.
Later, yes, that's exactly right. One of the first listings I gave him, he didn't know it at the time, but I mean, you turn taking listings over last, and you do it when you've hit the point where you can't keep taking the listings because you're too busy. And when you start turning away business, see, when you have four listing appointments in a day, and you do that 3-4 days back to back, here's what's interesting. You wind up going on appointments where you hope they don't list. Like, you're too tired. I'm not making a joke. I mean, well, this is not my problem right now, but at that time, that was a problem I was solving. You go on an appointment, and you're thinking, if they list, it's going to take me an hour when I get back to the office to finish filling out these forms. I'm so damn tired right now. I hope they want to put it off, and I'll come back on a day when I'm not so busy. When you get to where, oh, that's too far, or that's too late, or that's too early, I don't want to take that, I don't want to drive all the way over there, that's time to hire a lister. That's when you go. You're getting rid of business anyway. So the only appointments I gave him the first month or so were people I would have never gone on the appointment anyway. That's what was funny. He didn't know that then. I mean, I never would have said to him, "You understand, I'm not giving you any of what I consider the good ones." But I wasn't. And it was just, these were the ones that I thought, I don't care what he does, because I wasn't going to go anyway. And when I started getting closings off the ones he was going on, I started giving him more and more business. So initially, I was doing 80% of the listing appointments. He was doing 20. And as he got better and better, I changed it ultimately to where I was doing about 20%. And he was doing about 80%. Then what happened, and I don't recommend what I'm about to say to anyone, I got cancer. And once I got started on chemo, I mechanically couldn't go. This was 11 years ago. I couldn't go on the appointments because I was just too doped up with chemo. So I then took my top buyer agent, and every time I've put a lister on post, it is always without exception, we've promoted them from someone who was handling buyers. I would never, under any circumstances, hire a lister. I mean, I just would never do it. I just turn the business down because I may as well. You just wind up with overpriced crap or someone who doesn't really care. It's just a different deal. So I hire buyer agents once they're a proven team member, and I need a lister, that's where I get them. But I don't ever go out and hire them. So once I knew that he was doing a great job, and once I had chemo, I took my top buyer agent at the time and made her a lister, and where she was doing about half listings, half buyers, and eventually it got to where she was doing just fine. And so I had two listers, and when I brought a third one on, when she was starting to burn out from too many appointments during the market in 2005, it just worked out that way. So I haven't been on a list. I haven't had a buyer in my car since 93, and I haven't been on a listing appointment since 2001.
For a listing specialist, how many listings can they take? What's the maximum number that you think they can take before you need to bring on another one?
Oh, let me think. Depends on their tolerance for work and their number of hours. My top guy, actually, I would say with Bill or JC now, if they got three appointments a day, they'd be happy. They could comfortably go on three every day if they wanted, if we had that much work. Right now, we don't have that many appointments, but they could do that. Two a day would be a walk in the park for them, because that's all they do, is just to do the listings. I mean, they don't do anything else but that. They're not doing contracts or follow up on the stuff or anything like that. So the way I have it organized, three in a day, two to three, depending on the agent's workload. I think of it in terms of number of appointments.
All this listing specialist does is go out to the appointment, get the listing signed, bring it back to the office, and they're done.
Yeah, they order up the sign, they put it in MLS, that kind of thing. Like they put it into multiple listing, upload the photos they've got, and then they're out. Then I have my admin staff take it from there.
The listing specialist does take photos and measurements of the property.
Mm-hmm.
And that information will go into the system. How long do you think that it takes the typical start to finish for a listing specialist when they list a property? How many hours do they have into that?
Well, because we list in a very broad geographic area, like if I say that the city of Phoenix is 480 square miles, the cities around Phoenix, so if I tell you we, my office, we will list between, depending on the year, between 400 and 600 listings a year. We list properties in about an area that would be approximately 2,000 square miles.
That's huge.
Yeah, it is huge. And so that's so different. When you're doing radio and television, like if someone goes, well, I wouldn't want to do that, well, then you probably won't want to advertise on radio or TV, because radio and TV, if you just think of the term broadcasting, you start to get a concept of this isn't something you're controlling on where this goes. And so it goes all over. So if you're going to pay the rates for an ad, even if you have an effective ad that's been tested, you're going to go like television. If I'm not talking cable now, travels, it's about a 75-mile signal. So you're paying for that advertising whether you're using it or not. So unlike a geographic farm that's got a contained thing, this is not contained. We might get a call from an area that's, say, roughly an hour away. We go there to take a listing. So they have 2 hours driving from our office, you understand, round trip. We allow 2 hours for the average listing appointment. And I figure every time they take a listing, so right now they're going to take listings on about half the appointments, it's going to take them an additional hour to fill out the papers after they take the listing and put it in the system and so forth.
And how long is the appointment typically from start to finish while they're at the house?
I would say 2 hours.
So 2 hours. So if they drive an hour, they're there for 2 hours, drive back an hour, they have maybe 5 hours into it?
If they took the listing. But some appointments are short. I mean, it depends on what kind of personality you're talking to. Like if you're familiar with the DISC system, if you're talking to a high D, I don't think you could stay in their house 2 hours. If you're talking to a high C, try and do it in less. You know, when someone says, well, do you do a one-step or a two-step listing appointment? To me, the question shows someone hasn't been on enough appointments, or if it's an instructor telling people how to do it, I go, yeah, I'm real charmed. Here's the problem. If you're talking to a D, if your seller is a D, you can do all appointments in one step. They don't want to keep talking to you. But if you have a high C who's like a real detail type person, you're not going to take the listing in very many cases on your first appointment. They're going to want to sleep on it, then call you the next day going, come on back. And to sit there using closing techniques to avoid that, I think is asinine. Just go with it. like it just it's part of the deal. So how long does an appointment take? Some appointments will take 3 hours. Some appointments take 10 minutes. I know if we have to allow drive time and we have to allow an average of a couple of hours for an appointment. If we have some, because if we don't know what personality type until we get there, it might be a while. If somebody has a jillion questions, the first-time home seller, I don't want them to feel rushed or pressured. I don't see what the upside is of that.
How do you compensate the listing specialist?
They get 20% of the listing commission. They get, so if we, of the listing side, so let's pretend we had a $3,000 commission on the listing side. The lister would get 20% of that, or $600. My top guy, just to put this in perspective, my top guy in 2006, my top listing specialist, made just under $300,000 his share. And his expenses would have been his board dues and his gas and dry cleaning. Now, that's not this last year and in the last couple of years with our market, that hasn't been the deal. But I'm just putting this in perspective. So,
because of the volume, the 20% adds up?
Yep.
We haven't talked about it yet, but I know you have a flexible fee schedule.
Mm-hmm.
How does the 20% adjust when you do an in-house transaction?
It adjusts just like you would think. And if someone wants to see my fee schedule, they can go to nohassellisting.com and just click on the seller side, and my commission schedule's right there online, has been for years. It goes 6, 4, 1, or 0. So most of our deals are going to be at 6% because most of them are going to have a co-broke. So we're paying out the 3. But in the event that it's a 4%, we just whatever the listing side was, we're going to, including if it was a 1% deal, which are now starting to come back again because our market's half traditional sellers again. So we're starting to see those. Then the listing agent would get just that percent.
They would get 20% of the 1%.
That's not much money, but we're not doing that many of those. So that's almost at the level of taking one for the team, because it's hardly that wouldn't have been what they wanted to do, but it just works out that way sometimes.
In the situation where it's in-house and it's 4%, are you splitting that fee 50-50 between your buyer agent and your listing agent?
No, the lister would still get 20% of the 3%. My buyer agents were in a 50-50 split, but if they sell one of our listings, they're getting 1%. The buyer agent's getting 1%. It's because I'm actually making the same amount of money. So we're splitting. If I do a 4% deal, the buyer agent gets 1%, where if they were selling someone else's listing that was 3%. But in that case, they're usually only showing one house. So it works out for them, too.
So your buyer agent will take a lesser fee overall when it's an in-house transaction, and your listing agent is basically receiving the same amount as they would have if it were sold to another agent.
Yes, that's correct.
That hasn't been a problem to disincentivize your buyer agent for selling the home?
No, we've never had a problem with it. In fact, if I had someone working for me where I thought it was a problem, I'd probably not want them working for me. And I mean that quite literally. There's two hats that anybody who works for me in sales has to wear. One would be the individual post hat, and the other one would be the group member hat. And that's why I would never, ever, ever hire a listing specialist. I would only take someone who was a proven, trustworthy, see, it's not like I'm looking for a closer as my listing specialist, but someone who I go, I trust them. I know they're honest. I know they are part of the group. And that's the only person I ever want taking listings for me. As opposed to, am I looking for a closing technique? Not at all. I'm looking for someone who's honest, forthright. Somebody asks them a question, they'll answer the question that was actually asked. They don't, doesn't mean they're not salespeople, but I'm not looking for some kind of a, we're going to talk somebody into something. Since I already have a deal that says my client can cancel anytime they want to. Like, if they're not happy, fire me. Well, if you're going to run a program like that, I don't know what the advantage would be to talk someone into something that didn't make complete sense for them, only to have them discover it. You mean you'd just be wasting your own time anyway. But someone who wasn't a group member wouldn't see it that way. So that's why I wouldn't want that kind of person working for me.
What percentage of your transactions are you double ending in this 4% issue even comes up?
I don't know that I could answer your question. It changes based on market conditions. I haven't tabulated it. I mean, my buyer agents, I have five of them, would love to sell my listings every time if they could. I mean, we're not having some disincentive in doing it. In fact, quite the opposite, because they know how the transaction is going to get handled all the way around. So we don't have a barrier to it. But if you said, what's the actual number? I don't know if I know. I don't think I know the answer to your question. Not that I won't tell you. I don't think I can tell you.
Let's stick on listings here for a couple more minutes. Why do sellers hire you?
Well, sellers hire me for the same reason they hire any listing person. And that would be they believe that we can get them the most money in the least time with the least amount of aggravation. That's what sellers actually want. The seller's hoping to get the highest net possible. Like, you know, in certain markets when, well, for example, like late 2005, early 2006, when the discount companies got a bigger toehold than they ever had in history because the an overheated seller's market that ran longer than one ever had in history, and you found discount companies. Well, when you had agents becoming a commodity, see, for the last 5-6 years, agents have not been much of a commodity, because if you're talking about a seller, it wasn't like, well, anyone can do. In fact, the discount companies pretty much went out of business, most of them, just because it wasn't perceived by the public. This has nothing to do with whether it's true or not. It just wasn't perceived by the public to still be able to get the job done the same way. So anytime you have someone, whether it's an area specialist, someone who I specialize in this area, well, people hire them because there's this perception, true or not, that this is the person who knows the area best. That doesn't even happen to necessarily be a fact. It's just what the public believes.
So they have the perception that you are the best agent in the area.
Yeah, I think that's true. But most people hire someone they know. Like if just being well-known was the main requirement to get business, I would have all the business in Phoenix. And I don't, I promise. So the bulk of the business I'm not getting isn't where I'm losing it out to some amazing agent. It's just some random person they happen to know. And that's how it usually works. How the business you're usually not getting is how you're losing it to some person that they know.
Do you send out a pre-listing package before your interview?
We did. Again, for years, these last few years have just sort of changed everything. But yes, my pre-listing package is also online, and they can download it. It's called my information packet, that's online, and they can see it there. But if I tell you, up until the market went haywire in 2007, we sent a pre-listing package in almost every instance. And if they called and we were going out that day, we took it with us and gave it to them when we got to the house.
Once 2007 hit, you stopped doing that?
The subprime meltdown, August of 2007, the market collapsed. And so when you send a pre-listing package, it wouldn't matter what you were doing, and you couldn't even guess the price of a house in my area back then. So what did we do? I don't know that it would matter to say, here's what we did then. We were losing money rapidly is what we were doing.
How did you survive that?
I fortunately had made enough money prior to that we lost that first year just because our overhead's so high. We lost, well, I would say in 2008, my net loss would have been right at $400,000.
Wow.
That's a lot of money to pay to get to have an office. You can go, like, nice business. Oh, it's great.
That's a house.
yeah, there you go.
So how did you adapt? What did you do when the market changed so dramatically?
I finally went into short sales, and we have a huge short sale op. We did 161, I think, last year. Closed. and we've done hundreds of short sales. It was a survival thing, but that market's changing already. The market is changing away from short sales already in my area, and I believe will nationally too. I mean, Phoenix is sort of leading the parade on that, but nevertheless, REOs, the REO inventory is essentially gone. There's just a tiny, tiny bit. It's less than 20% of our market now. And as it continues to dwindle, like short sales have become more and more prominent. But that's changing as well.
So you see your market moving back to a traditional market?
It already has. It's not finalized yet, but it already is moving. Over half the sales now are traditional sellers.
Russell, where's your market? Where are you working?
Phoenix, Arizona.
Describe your current real estate market.
It would be slightly over half. It's rebounded slightly over half. Our traditional sellers, prices are rising at a faster rate than they ever have in history. Last month, the average price per square foot went up about 7%. That's unprecedented. And median prices, by the way, if this is an important little point, median prices are a horrifically awful, stupid method of attempting to track short-term price movement. Economists don't know this, apparently, because they keep trying to forward this, but you cannot ever accurately track short-term price movement by looking at median prices moving. It would never give you an accurate number. It tells you what's selling, not how much it's selling for. So its average price per square foot would be the correct thing if you're trying to forecast what's happening. And what's been happening in our market is that's just been moving up at a clip that's just unprecedented in terms of the speed.
Is that because the market fell so dramatically?
Well, our market's still underpriced, but it's really because you'll see this all across the country. There's a shortage of inventory. Prices are regulated by supply and demand, and there's a shortage of inventory. And people go, well, how come there's a shortage of inventory? Well, I can tell you, again, speaking just for Phoenix, in 2006, we had slightly over 400 home builders here in the Valley. By mid-2008, that number was down to less than 20. Now, so you get, and by the time the merry-go-round ride stopped in fourth quarter of 07, we had an inventory overhang of 55,000 homes that no one ever needed. There was no economic reason to have ever built any of them. It was so investors could buy them to resell them to other investors. But the fact of the matter is that all that stuff's gone, the foreclosures. We've had 230,000 foreclosures here in the Valley. Our market's recovered. Delinquent loans are now down, I know, like right at between 6 and 7%. The problem's practically fixed here.
Do you think that was because people moved away and then came back? Are you getting an influx of people and employment? What's been the turnaround?
I don't know that I could answer that question. I think because I don't really try to gauge I'm like studying the whole economy to see what's going to happen with housing. I know I'm just looking at the supply demand of housing here. I'm real clear on we have a severe shortage of inventory. It's never been this low and prices have never been going up that fast. If someone says, well, does this tell me that all industries are going to be doing real well? No, it doesn't tell me that. It tells me what's happening with housing. I don't know that I can draw some inference from this to go, well, let me say what this means. When I hear people go, there's a shadow inventory, I go, no, there isn't. There most certainly isn't here. There absolutely isn't here. I don't believe there's one anywhere. I wish there was. If there was and they just dumped it all on our market right away, I don't think it'd take more than a week or two for us to absorb every last one of them. So if there were a shadow inventory, I think it'd be delightful. Release it. The theory that the banks are working together to hold properties back so they can sell them later when they're going to be worth more, or they're doing this to avoid flooding the market as though they knew how to manage anything, it's such an absurd concept that they run things efficiently. or they do things that would even be in their own self-interest. But no, there's we've counted them here. I mean, you get companies like RealtyTrack that the stuff they spew out and call data, if I just characterized it as worthless tripe, and if they wanted to sue me, I'd go, please do. I'm comfortable with that because the stuff they print, the stuff they say, the stuff they churn out, it's not simply worthless. Worthless implies it has zero value. I consider that stuff has a hideous negative value because it's simply false information. It is not accurate. They do not know how to count. They count odd things, and they have no concept of what they're even talking about. So you couldn't use that data. Case-Shiller, which is the most respected national index, is a minimum of 4 months out of date the day it's published. So, and it's usually 5 months in arrears. Well, in a local market, that's worthless. If you want to know where you were, Case-Shiller would be accurate. But if you want to know where you're going, you can't use it. You can't use it because local markets turn on a dime.
You're in the middle of your local market. You're saying you're seeing this uptick. Is it across all price ranges?
All except the top. The exceptions to it on price rising is, in our market, is the real high end. It still has lots of inventory. If you want to buy a house for $2 or $3 million, you can. You know, you want to think it over. I'm not making a joke. You could look at it and go, I'll come back in a few days. I'm going to look at some more. You could do that if you're buying a house for a couple of million. If you're trying to buy a house for a couple of hundred thousand, it'll have, if it's a decent property, it'll have multiple offers instantaneously. Now, the only other area that didn't have the wild price swings is the 55-plus communities. We didn't have the prices shoot way down, and they're not rising now because there's no shortage of inventory in those 55-plus communities.
In your market, do you believe you have a niche or a specialization?
Not really. We're not a luxury agent. I mean, I sell houses for $1 million-plus, but there's luxury agents that their average price, a true luxury agent in our market would have an average price of $1 million or more. And I'm certainly not, and that's not what we do. We work valley-wide. We list houses for $50,000. We list houses routinely for $500,000. And we do, I mean, literally day in, day out. So we might have inventory brought in any random day, 150, 50, 250, 350, 700,000. We're all across the boards. So I don't have a part of town or a type of product that we, like, this is our home. Our home is the market.
Could you tell us the different ways that you're generating leads and business?
Well, my number one method, and this has been true for 20 years, is radio and TV ads. That's probably 80% of our business right there. We get, obviously, repeat and referral. We do, I don't know, maybe 70, 80 deals a year from repeat and referral. It might even be closer to 100 now. I haven't counted it recently. Last time I counted it was around, I think it was 75, 80, I can't remember exactly, but it would be normal for us to do, from repeat and referral, maybe 80 deals a year, something like that. So I'm guessing now that number is probably closer to 100 just as we've grown, but I don't actually know, but it'd be somewhere like that. And, you know, there's some agents that can live off repeat and referral, but 100 deals a year isn't enough business for us to live off of. It's too big an operation. But if you wanted, like, could you do 100 deals a year strictly off repeat and referral? My answer is absolutely. And for someone who has a low enough overhead, or that's just as high as they care to go, that would actually be a business right there. But for us, it's the bulk of it is radio and television. I do have a some papers we send out, like a geographic thing near the office, and that's we send out about 44,000 copies, and we do get business off that. I couldn't tell you what percentage of our business it is because for the last 3-4 years, all I've really used it for is to bring in people for our short sale seminars, which we wound up in the short sale business because the other business had gone away.
Let's go into each of those in a little more detail. Let's start out with the radio ads.
We were the first successful radio ad in the country. I will say that I think pretty much any agent anywhere in the country who's running a successful radio ad has copied mine with or without my permission. But either way, they've patterned it after mine. When I started, I have a background in radio. I used to, back in the early 70s, function pretty much like a small ad agency where I would write and produce radio commercials. When I finally decided to attempt, after 12 years in the business, to put the two together, my real estate background and my radio commercial background, I made a deal with a radio station where I produced for them, new each week, comedy that they could run on their channel in exchange for 10 free ads. Now, here's what's funny. It took me a year to get the phone to ring. Not to do a deal, by the way. To get the phone to ring. Just once. I was convinced they weren't running my ad. I thought they were lying to me. I thought they were tricking me and not running the ad. I would sometimes go to the station and talk to the on-air person. Say, have you ever actually run these? I just ran one. I mean, they weren't going to fib something to me. And the truth of the matter was, every radio ad that anyone had ever used, I would go out of my way to get a copy of it, and I would just put my name where their name was, thinking, since their ad must have been successful if they kept doing it. Well, that was my mistake. It had never been successful. What had actually happened is the radio stations would talk people into, real estate agents, into you have to advertise for at least 90 days to see make it work. Actually, I found, after I got to doing it and had to branch out from more than one station, I found actually I could test a station in 1 week. Because either you have bad copy or you have a bad station, and if you've already tested the copy, then I knew the only variable was the station. Since I knew my copy worked, it took me a long time. It took us a year of trial and error to perfect that copy. It was bewildering to me because every single thing I ever dreamed would work, it didn't. It just didn't. And I couldn't believe it. But what we have on the air today is a variation of what we ran roughly 20-some years ago. It's the same ad. We just update it from time to time to keep it current, but it's essentially the same ad. And I found that changing that ad was just a stupid thing to do. I go back to what Jack Benny said. It's much easier to get a new audience than a new act.
I've actually been able to cue a radio ad up. Let's listen to it for a minute. And then you and I can chat about it. Here we go.
Homes are selling, and so are we. In fact, twice as fast as the average agent. I'm Russell Shaw with Realty One Group. We help more home sellers sell than any other agent, and most at full price or more. In fact, it takes 71 ordinary agents to sell the number we sell. I'm not bragging. I'm applying for a job. I want to be your realtor. And if you're not happy, fire me. Mind you, I think you'll be happy because my no-hassle listing has flexible commissions, sell it yourself and pay nothing, cancel any time. Found your own buyer and just need help? We can take it from contract to close. For a free information package, call 957-7777. For 34 years, selling homes is what we do best. Can't make your house payment? Don't foreclose. Get up to $3,000 to do a short sale. Attend our free short sale seminar. Valleywide, 602-957-7777 or nohassellisting.com. Thank you.
That's a fantastic ad.
Well, Wendy wrote it. So Wendy Shaw gets credit for writing the ad, tweaking the ad, keeping the ad current.
And Wendy is?
Wendy and I were married in 1982. We're actually splitting up, but she still wrote that ad, and we still work together in the business. And she gets credit for the quality of the ad. She's the executive producer of the ad when we go into the studio. Like, you don't want to ever rely on someone in the studio to tell you that ad is good enough or that ad isn't good enough, because what they're going to be looking for is, are you popping your peas? How are your levels? That kind of thing. And I've seen so many times over the years where someone would send me their ad copy. I would tweak it for them, tell them, no, don't write this, do it this way, don't say it that way, say it this way. And they would take ad copy that I knew would work, go into the studio, record a spot, and it would not work. And then I would say, please send me a copy of the ad. I remember one really, really nice lady, if you ever met her, her name was Mary Charters with Keller Williams out of Maryland, and she did the ad, and they spent, Joe and Mary spent $50,000 on TV ads, never got a call. And I said, send me a copy of the ad. I personally approved that. I literally looked at her ad copy, I rewrote it, and I sent it back to him. So I thought, this shouldn't be happening. Well, if you saw the ad, you'd see why it was happening. Lighting was perfect. The camera angles were perfect. Mary, if you ever met her, you would find Mary was this energetic, instantly likable, affable, charming person. In the TV ad, if Mary had been doing a professional actor's version of a zombie, it would look just perfect. And I'm not making it, I mean literally. It was just this stiff, staring straight ahead like a deer in the headlights, and half the ad, half the point of the ad is you want to come across to someone they can like and trust. So not only does the copy have to be just right, the delivery has to be just right. And if the delivery's not just right, and so you're not going to get someone from a radio or TV station to keep sending it back again and again and again to have it re-edited, and I don't like this look, and I don't like that, and this doesn't look just right. That's got to come from someone who doesn't work there at the station, because it's just more work to them. It'll come across me that what you can count on from them will be sort of a stable horse mentality on, yep, this is fine, you should be good to go. And not good to go. When I saw the ad, I remember calling him back. I can tell you what's wrong. It looks like hell. The delivery's terrible. And the guy, he says to me, but they told me it was fine. Well, of course. What are they judging? They're going, the lighting was perfect. The lighting was perfect. She's in the frame exactly. They don't know what a good ad's supposed to look like. If they did, they wouldn't be working behind a camera. I'm not making fun of them. I'm just going, that's not their area of expertise. That's the kind of stuff that, so if you want to get it right, you have to have someone who knows what your good look is. How would you sound if you sounded just right, if you sounded natural? Because if it has a phony sound, and because people, if they're not used to doing a recording, the truth of the matter is, they may not be comfortable in a studio. And sometimes you can be talking to someone, shove a microphone in front of them, all of a sudden they freeze up. So if they're stilted, if the delivery's stilted, the commercial isn't going to play well.
Or they're tired after multiple takes.
Yeah, and I've had people write me and say, will you help me with my commercial? I tell them what to do. I tell them exactly what to do. I had one recently. I thought, okay, waste your money. I'm not going to debate with you. I told him, do not use music. Do not use a music bed. So I say, send me a sample of it. He sends it to me. And I'm doing this for free, you understand? And he sends it to me and says he's real busy. I said, well, it has music. You don't want music. He goes, yeah, but I'm real busy now, so I haven't time to recut it. I'm done talking to him. This isn't something where I'm going to debate with the guy, like, don't do it. If he wants to waste his money, I can tell you, it's not like a science fair project. When I say to someone, do not advertise on a sports station, they go, why? I don't know why. I can just tell you it doesn't work. Would I run one of my ads on a sports station? Absolutely not, never. If you say, why not? I don't know why not. I just know it doesn't work. I've tried it. We've tried everything, and we know what doesn't work because we did it. It doesn't work. We only run on news talk. Why is that better? I guess because, and it's like I only run the TV ads on the news. No, people do not TiVo the news to watch later. So whatever they have watching then, you get it then. And why no music? Because on talk stations, when the announcers are talking, you actually hear them talking. So I want it to seem like editorial content of the stations.
What are the elements to the ad we just listened to you've developed over many years? Why is it successful? You've mentioned some of these big picture items. Are there items inside the ad that you found hot buttons that people respond to?
Yes. Cancel anytime. Sell it yourself while listed. I'm not bragging. I'm applying for a job. I took that out one time because it was getting old. And what I found is took it out and my phone started ringing late at night. You egotistical son of a bitch. They'd hang up. And you go, why would people do that? I don't know. Maybe they like to drink, and when they're drinking, but what I know is I was getting those calls.
And you weren't before.
We weren't before. So you say, well, isn't that silly? Well, of course it's silly, but it doesn't matter. So if you're going to make the statements, I put in, I'm not bragging, I'm applying for a job. Of course I'm bragging. But apparently it's okay if I say I'm not bragging.
You mentioned, is it 71 times the average agent?
Yeah, my real number is over 100. I just use the number 71 currently because it sounds more believable, like we calculated it. The truth is the average agent doesn't even sell 6 houses a year right now. If you took the total number of agents, you could do the same thing nationally. If you took the total number of MLS members and then you take the total number of houses being sold and divide the little number into the big number, you get the average number of houses they're selling. You take a company like back when the market was good, for example, and normal, a company like Coldwell Banker, their agents average like 11 deals a year. Currently, Realty Executives here in town, their agents are averaging currently 11 deals a year. This is a company whose name used to equal success, and they're currently averaging 11 deals a year per agent. So that'll give you an idea. So if you took a company like Keller Williams, I think their average number of deals per agent right now is around 6, something like that. So if you get the idea, so I could claim I'm selling more than 100 agents, but I don't want to make a claim that sounds outrageous. So take something that's more believable.
That's resonating with the people listening and you're getting more calls.
Well, yes. I mean, it absolutely resonates. For anyone who's going to do any kind of marketing, if you're going to spend money on marketing, the book you want to read is The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing by Al Reeves and Jack Trout. That's Jack Trout, T-R-O-U-T, and Al Reeves, R-I-E-S. I think that's the most important book on marketing ever written, period.
And it's easy to read.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. To me, it just dwarfs other books on the subject of marketing. So if you're going to spend money, I'm not talking about guerrilla marketing. I'm talking about where you're going to see people talk about, well, they say, well, everything's marketing. Everything is not marketing. If you are eating dinner, you're not marketing. You're eating dinner. There's two ways to get business. There's exactly two ways to get business, prospecting or marketing. If you are doing marketing, you're doing something to get them to reach toward you. And if you're doing prospecting, you're doing something to reach to them. That's it. So if you're getting business, you're doing one of the two. You're either prospecting or you're marketing. We have a marketing-based business. For example, some people have a prospecting-based business. A prospecting-based business has advantages over a marketing-based business in that when the market changes, you can almost instantaneously change your message. You find out what you were doing doesn't work because you're standing right there and it's not working. It takes much longer and it's considerably more expensive to change your message marketing because it takes longer to get the feedback. It'd be like if you were standing in a comedy club telling jokes and you said something's not funny, at least to that audience. Well, you can see it's not because they're not laughing. They're right there not laughing. But now imagine you're doing a radio show. Well, you just said something that's not funny. You think it's funny, but they don't think it's funny. Well, how do you know? You don't know. It's harder. It's harder to connect unless you've tested that material. So to find out what a current valid message is something that we're constantly, I make it a point to talk to people on the phone, my clients. I personally take incoming seller calls a couple times a month just so I'm finding out when the public perception is changing so that we don't have some stuck idea, because what most people do, they make the mistake, if they don't survey the public, they survey themselves. Like, here's what I think's important. It doesn't matter what I think's important. It's what do they think's important. Do they think this is valuable? Like the stations I advertise on, I don't listen to them. These aren't my favorite stations. I'm not trying to get me to call me. I'm not trying to get me to call. I already have my business. I'm not trying to get my friends to call me. I already have their business. I'm trying to get strangers to call me.
This is the end of part one. The interview continues on part two.